CIUT 89.5 FM, celebrating 35 years as the sound of your city. Proudly student and listener-supported community radio.
Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT. That's always makes it good to come in with Lee Morgan. Today on the show, we're going to be talking to Robin Philpott. Robin has written a very important article in Dimension Magazine. We say magazine today. Everything is on the internet, even if it is a magazine, about the this curious development we talked about on the show, on this show last week, concerning the use of human rights as a kind of doctrine for part of the new Cold War, a technique for putting your opponent as they say in soccer, to wrong-foot him. And the problem with it is that the it flows from the notion of unilateral creation and execution of human rights. In other words, it's the old U.S. doctrine, and first, I think, enunciated by the elder Bush, who said that there's a new world order. And in the new world order, part of the plan was human rights, and those who do not accept the New World Order, which is led by the exceptional country, the number one country, as all American presidents in modern history made it very clear that in international matters, America's number one. Years ago, it was thought of as an isolationist idea, which is they didn't say they were number one. They said that they didn't care what the rest of the world was doing, and they would just basically ignore it. That was sort of the old. People often today invoke the word isolationist. They got that wrong. The isolationists didn't propose to go out and dominate everything in every sphere. They definitely wanted to dominate this hemisphere. That's for sure, the Monroe Doctrine. That's what that was about. But as to the rest of the world, that was the people called isolationists didn't want to assume leadership. But that after World War II, it's become a doctrine. And Robin Philpott is discussing the developments with Russia, Ukraine, where now we have people talking about tribunals and trials for people who committed crimes. And it is, and of course, it comes from a unipolar position. And the important personalities associated with the concept of human rights are being heard from. And they're playing I would call it an accessory to NATO. But anyway, we'll get into all that with Robin. And we're also going to talk about the issue of Quebec and the question that has arisen at the National Assembly, where now a substantial number of elected members of the Quebec National Assembly are refusing to swear an oath of allegiance to King Charles III. And speaking of Charles, I mean, this we should dedicate the segment to Charles Roach, a brilliant lawyer and a fighter for underdogs everywhere, and a Pan-Africanist. That was one of his passions, and he made this an issue, tried to make it an issue. Basically, of course, came up against the wall of Anglo-chauvinism and love of monarchs. So that's another matter we'll get into. I want to announce also that the There was a program in Hamilton, a very important one. I would say the organizers are courageous because we're in troubled times, and the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War had speakers, and it was called a teach-in, appropriately, and issues were discussed of how we got into this, how we are, maybe we should put it, how we are getting into this more and more deeply. It is more and more dangerous, Canadian people, but voices are not heard. Sensible ones, challenging NATO, challenging the approach taken by Western capitals under our president, the president of NATO, Joe Biden, and his vassals called NATO. And among the vassals are the most, is the shiny one, the Maple Leaf vassal. And you can find the talks on the website of the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, and I really urge you to go there and to, so that you can listen to the presentations and some of the and questions and answers. This is what we need, more questions and hopefully more answers. One thing before we talk to Robin, I want to compliment the Globe and Mail. I rarely do so. When you have something nice to say, you should say it. And the Globe and Mail on Saturday, October 22nd, had they do a thing called a moment in time. And the moment in time that they bring to our attention is October 22, 1895. And they talk about an individual I had never heard of, and it breaks my heart to think about him. The title of the article, and it's in that, it's a special that they do periodically. Almighty Voice is arrested, and that was his name. There's a wonderful photograph of him, a very intense man with braids, and he's an impressive individual to look at. And under his picture it says, Almighty Voice, it's a person, shown in an undated photo, escaped from detention and went on the run. He was ultimately killed when police shelled his hiding place 19 months later. And I think it's probably worth reading. They can sue me, I guess. It was treaty payment day at the One Arrow Reserve in central Saskatchewan in October 1895. Acting on a tip from an informant, two Northwest Mounted Police officers used the gathering to arrest Almighty Voice, a 21-year-old Willow Cree, who had butchered a rancher's stray cow for food several months earlier. Almighty Voice was taken to nearby Duck Lake. Duck Lake should live in infamy, by the way. Look up Duck Lake and what happened there. He was taken to Duck Lake, where he spent the night in a makeshift bed in a corner of the Northwest Mounted Police Detachment. The sergeant in command of the barracks didn't regard the charge as a serious offense. He expected the young man to receive a stern warning at his hearing the next morning, but the justice of the peace, who would dispense the white man's justice, was the same Indian agent who Almighty Voice had once threatened to kill. I'm going to call that an allegation. That's the Taylor Report. Continuing. That night, when the guard went upstairs to the sleeping quarters to rouse his relief, Almighty Voice slipped out of the door. The fugitive was on the run for the next 19 months. Before police shelled his hiding place and killed him in a bluff east of the reserve in late May 1897. Here's the sentence that fascinates me. It closes the article written by Bill Wather. Three Mounties and one civilian died during the pursuit. I thank the Globe for publishing this. It's a great photograph. I will put it on my wall. Of a man called Almighty Voice, bless his heart. But I wish they had noted that they had killed him, since he was arrested on this date, October 22, 1895. But good for them. It's what they call a conversation piece, and we could all use more of these. I hope maybe on the and maybe we could talk to the author, Bill Weiser. I'm glad he wrote the piece, because knowing more about what happened to the Willow Cree Almighty Voice would help us all understand how we came to be in such a horrible situation where everyone's now apologizing and saying, oh, yes, they did that, as though that were ancient history. There are a few people incarcerated who would like to discuss this matter. Did I say a few? This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT. It is 89.5 FM. And again, I'll mention that the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War will be posting, perhaps has posted, the video audio of the conference, this teach-in on the current crisis regarding Ukraine and Russia. I was among the speakers, so I was glad to be there. I think we're joined now by Robin Philpott. Are you there, Robin?
Hey. Yes, I am. Thank you. Yeah.
Robin, we've been we're very pleased to be talking to you, because on a couple of matters, we want, of course, in the second half, we want to talk about your dramatic development regarding the Quebec legislators. But I'd like to begin with the matter, the article you published in Canadian Dimension. It's called The Unbalanced Scales of International Criminal Justice. And the subtitle is The Current Calls to Indict Russian Authorities and Citizens Resemble What NATO Did in 2011 to Libya and Muammar Gaddafi. It seems to me this is a very important matter you're raising. And you start with, I would call it an unforgettable quotation. I'd say you caught them red-handed, as it were, because certainly anybody following the crisis involving Ukraine, Russia, have noticed a lot of positioning in the West, particularly Ottawa and London, of trying to criminalize the Russian leadership, not on the issue of war itself so much, although they do, but they want to have a war crimes kind of auxiliary to their general NATO position. And I'll leave it to you, but okay. How do you contextualize it and particularly give us this lovely quote that is the linchpin of your article?
Yeah, the starting point, and it is important because it starts with the very first criminal tribunal, International Criminal Court, which is for what was set up for the ex-former Yugoslavia. And the man who makes the quote was one of President Clinton's chief advisors and chief actors. In other words, he was a guy who was involved in the negotiation, he's very proud of it, of the five international criminal tribunals, which were created under Clinton between 1992 and 2000. His name is David Sheffer, and he was the U.S. ambassador at large for war crimes issues in the second mandate. But before that, he was the lead negotiator for the U.S. And he was writing in his, self-aggrandizing memoirs, but you have to take it exactly as he says it. And he said, the War Crimes Tribunal was an important judicial tool. And then he adds, I had enough support from the President Clinton, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, Secretary of Defense William Cohen, and other top officials in Washington to wield it like a battering ram in the execution of U.S. and NATO policy. So he just says right out that that's what they were trying to do with a judicial tool, with a tribunal.
Justice now, as a battering ram.
In the execution of U.S. and NATO policy.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was in what
the Americans love these word tool. When I'm remembering Colin Powell, and they were first invading Iraq. They did it a couple times actually, and he said, "We have some things in our toolbox.
Right.
We got it in our toolbox, and here's another tool." You say, what's the morality, the ethics, the behind that kind of language? It's just, it's like somebody, it's an amoral thing to say,
right?
That you're using something as a tool.
Right.
You know, who are you to do that?
Right, and who are you to do it, and what are you trying to accomplish? In any case, it's the proof that it is not justice, because justice is you know, like
blind,
equal.
Right? Justice is blind.
Justice is blind, exactly. And so you're not using a tool for anybody. It is to basically find the truth and protect the society and not advance. And it's based on equality. And once again, the context is important because 2 years before this began, because that was 93. Spring 93, when they created the first tribunal, and he was one of the negotiators. He was so proud of it. But this was after the New World Order had been heralded in 1990, or was it when the Eastern, when the end of the Soviet Union by George Bush Sr. So
Big Bush.
Big Bush. This was what they were trying to do in the New World Order. Basically, a term that we can use, I guess, is weaponized justice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that's what they were trying to do. And you know, as Ramsey Clark, who of course you know much more than I do, but I interviewed him for my book on Rwanda, and he pointed out that in 1945. And he was there. He was in Nuremberg. I mean, that's one thing. He's got this massive history and had so much knowledge and experience, but he was in Nuremberg. And then when the meetings were held to create the UN, he said that if there had even been the slightest mention of the creation of an international criminal tribunal, the meeting would never have taken place in San Francisco. And he said, the first people to have left would have been the United States.
Yes.
In other words, they will not. And he said, power does not like to be judged, and it will not be judged if it has enough power to prevent it.
Mm.
So he made it very clear that this idea of an international criminal tribunal was something that was impossible in a world that was a multilateral world. So, but when they created the unipolar world, as people call it now, that was one of the things that they were going to do, was weaponize justice, which is a contradiction in terms. So, that's how it started. And what we're having now is an attempt to repeat that, to use it against Russia and against any people who want to stand up to the United States. So, and there's a lot of examples of how it's coming about. If you we can go over them, but how they're trying, they're upping the ante, trying to give themselves a veneer of justice in the position that they are taking, NATO is taking with regards to Ukraine, and to criminalize anybody who says, well, maybe Russia had. Russia's defending itself. Maybe it has its own concerns, its own security concerns. So, and they're going to be criminalized for that.
Mm-hmm. Before I ask the next question, I want to just mention that on this matter of Ramsey's point, and incidentally, the quotes are in the article, and this is Robin Philpott, and it's, the article is in Canadian Dimension. Really urge people to go there, and of course, Robin is the editor-publisher of Baraka Books and has written on this subject for some time, actually, from various angles. But I think you're now, I'd say you've hit the what is the third rail, because this is the one that's going to inflame situation, because we no longer have a unipolar situation, at least as defined by the leaders of the People's Republic of China, Russia, and quite loudly of what used to be called third world states, developing countries, former colonies, who are not reinforcing America's authority in this quarter. But America seems to be determined to go forward with it. And the sensitive subject is that somehow or another, and this is really, I would invite our listeners and, of course, Robin Philpott to go into how this came to pass, that if someone who had been a judge, and he's from a NATO country, Norway, Moes, how he gets appointed to do something with the label UN inquiry. He visits Ukraine, and not Russia, by the way, but that's a long story too. But for a period of, I think, I heard he was appointed, and next thing I knew, the inquiry was over, and he had made it, and it was claimed then by all headlines in the Western media that there was, the United Nations had found that Russia had committed war crimes in Ukraine. And I know he's a judge. I know also that he can't be an investigator, because investigations can't happen in a week when you get off a plane, shake hands with the local people, and go out every morning and talk to somebody who says he knows something. That isn't investigation. That's a political theater or something. But anyway, you tell me. I mean, at last, very short order, how in the world did this happen?
Yeah, well, it's the model set up in the 90s where they appointed Judge Moes. Now, once again, it's the UN Human Rights Council, I think it's called that, the Office, the High Commission for Human Rights or something like that. They, which, as the Chinese have pointed out, that is very highly loaded, overloaded, U.S. and U.S. allies in that organization.
Yeah. Now, by the way, there's a place to kind of sort of freeze frame it. They're talking about the apparatchiks.
Yeah.
If within the apparatus, it weighted like 80%.
Yeah.
And by the way, I worked at the tribunal in Russia. Yeah. And Ramsey was there, and others were at both Yugoslav tribunal. But that is true of those tribunals.
Right.
That the apparatus, the people in the apparatus, you could call them NATO majority.
Yeah, exactly.
And say, how did that happen? It's, you know.
Right. Yeah. And so Eric Moes was set up this commission investigation. So he went to Kiel. He went, I think he toured around. Yeah, you have to. One thing you have to say as well is that he was under the protection of the Ukrainian army. Now they're unbiased, apparently. Are they impartial? They're part of a war,
of course.
He's under their protection, and they control the fact in a sense. And I know Ramsey said about that. That was a great problem in the Rwandan tribunal, because he said this is Victor's justice, because the RPF controls the facts. They control the territory. So Moes goes there, and I think it was a very long time. He got back. I think it was less than a couple of weeks. And with the two under investigators and two other investigators, and within about 3 months, they came out with a report, and the report is damning. Now, it's once again, Ramsey came out with the point, says you cannot underestimate the central wrong of selecting people for prosecution. They are choosing enemies, he said. It really is war by other means, and it's very cruel. So what Mose does is he goes there with a couple other people, and they start identifying the people who deserve to be prosecuted, along with and this is one thing. One other thing is that you have the Ukrainian, so-called Ukrainian justice system, which is doing the same thing now.
By the way, I would say fair is fair. If Ukraine, and I'm sure it has, the leadership in Kyiv has a prosecutor. They have attorney general. Yeah. They have all the apparatus. If they want to make and have made investigations, that's their business, and it is what it is. It's what, you know, I you don't have to say it. You think it's bad or you think it's good. That is their prerogative. Mm-hmm. But when the UN, the label UN is attached to a man from NATO, and he says, oh, I took their, basically, let's put it this way, he took their word for whatever they're telling him. He certainly was not the guy who went and turned the body over and looked and asked the forensic man how they came, this person died. He didn't do any of that. He's doing the, you know, the part where you sit at the table with the guys who may have done it. That is the investigation. So he's aiding and abetting something. He has no capacity to affirm.
Right, and he's basically playing the role of a propagandist. I mean, it is quite obvious that they come here and say, this is what's happened here and how you can put that. And so they have the words, the judicial words that they've used in the past other tribunals, where were things that will just really work in the media and say, and be parroted by our media, that they choose the words that they're going to use in their reports and their press releases, and that's what goes. Now, the thing about Mose, and this is one thing I think you've probably been talked about in the program, so tell me if I should stop talking about it, but Mose left a very sad trail. When he was head of he was judge at the Rwandan tribunal, the ICTR, from 1999 to 2009. The people, he left a terrible trail of human rights violation against Africans, against Rwandans, who were, I mean, he left the tribunal. It was a tribunal, once again, where they didn't have a prison. They didn't know where they were going to put them. They did not.
They claim they hadn't thought of it. And by the way, I have to believe they did. I think they just said, oh, we'll fix that when the time comes.
Yeah, and they also did not foresee any acquittals, because these were going to be expeditive trials, which were not expeditive. And so there are the people in Niger. Some of them were sentenced by Mose, who are left in limbo, in a kind of judicial apartheid in Africa. Now, the question you have to ask is, couldn't they have found somebody who didn't have blood on his hands like Mose? I mean, any self-respecting judge or judicial person should say, listen, I'm sorry, the last time... It didn't go the way I wanted.
Well, by the way, it's you know, it did not, in fact, quite end. In a way, it's still breathing, the ICTR. There's a trial at the moment. It could be the last. It being held at The Hague for the elderly gentleman, Mr. Kabuga. We talked about him on this program. But so this is, I would say, Moses is involved in all this. This is his handiwork. And couldn't we say to him, shouldn't you appropriately wrap up what you had responsible for? He was the president of the court. There may be two or three of them in all, three or four. I know Judge Kama was the first president, then it was Judge Pile, and then I think it was Judge Mose. All of them have a responsibility. They were wearing robes. They sat and looked down on the accused and judged them and put them away But then Away turned out to be for the acquitted, they also went to jail. You'd think, I'm really glad you raised the ethical. It seems to me, don't judges have ethics? You have a court that has become an embarrassment. It didn't actually dispense justice. So shouldn't you be working on correcting that rather than correcting Russians by way of meeting with Ukrainians?
Exactly. And so, but anyway, Mose, of course, what happens is he makes this report. And people, not everybody, but the media, our media, the stenographers, as some people say, our media, pick up the words, pick up the accusations, and then it becomes almost truth. Now, and this is where the link to Libya comes in. Last week, and another UN label came out, or last week it was maybe the fourth, about a week ago, 10 days ago, a woman by the name of Pamela Patton, who is called the UN Special Representative of the Secretary General on Sexual Violence, participated in a Paris press conference and said that acts of rape, mutilation, and sexual aggression were part of the Russian military strategy. Of course, she presented no evidence.
The guy says at the movie. Go on.
Yeah. And she also talked about the use of Viagra again. Viagra, as, the Viagra had been given to help the Russian soldiers.
This is becoming a commercial.
Women. And the rapes were committed against people between ages of 4 and 82. She didn't present any evidence at this press conference on the 14th in Paris. Mm-hmm. But she only referred, as far as I can see, to Judge Moses' report.
Yes. Now, I'm really glad you highlight that, because I don't think people have focused enough. It's almost like we're talking about the variations of COVID. She's working off the original Moses thing. And his report actually doesn't use those words. But somehow I don't know how this happened, but she's come up with language of her own claiming it has to do with the Moses investigation.
Right, exactly.
Inquiry. It's not inquiry.
Yeah.
And the inquiry found, she said, that Russians could remind us of the most famous instance of this. It's in your article, by the Canadian Dimension, Robin Philpott.
Yeah.
Susan Rice, a really distinguished American leader, she said, via her, go ahead.
Yeah, and by the way, the man who went through this in detail is Max Forte in a book we published, Slouching Towards Death. It's still available, and a very important book on what happened in Libya. But he really put it together, and you can just follow the development on the Libyan scene, where is that, I think it was these things seem to begin in March and April, but it was, or February, March. It was early in March, people go back in 2011. They started this story about no-fly zone. It was early in the year, February or early March. And early in March, Susan Rice said that there's sexual violence being commanded by Muammar Gaddafi, and he was using they were using Viagra. They had information leading.
Yes, Toronto Star reported it. The Globe reported it. They didn't say later, wow, that turned out to be a joke.
So immediately, this is within a few weeks, the ICC, the International Criminal Court, the chief prosecutor, Luis Moreno Ocampo, was off to Libya, where he he repeated the story and in fact said we're now getting proof of it. Of the Viagra story, and there was all this proof of sexual violence being used, and so they did their investigations, and of course this is all propaganda to justify the actual destruction of Libya, Libya, the most
destruction of Libya, and the murder of Gaddafi himself.
Yeah,
when the African Union specifically begged that they have a ceasefire, a negotiated settlement, but also the protection of his life, because Gaddafi had been seen by the African Union as a good friend. And when I say that, I'm quoting Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
A good friend. And Hillary Clinton said, well, we came, we saw, he died. Ha, 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 ha.
And yeah. people, you know, if you start raising that, you get accused of talking about whataboutism, as they say.
Yes.
But then you let's say what about. So this story of Viagra became one of the rallying points for the people who were going to back the bombing and destruction of Libya. The most profitable and the most prosperous country in Africa, and also where a lot of the money from the oil there was going into African countries. But that is all documented in Max Forte's book and how he was standing up. And that's why the African Union liked him so much. And so the International Criminal Court goes in there and starts doing exactly what Susan Rice wanted him to do, is proved that they were using Viagra, they were using a rape. And Ocampo even upped the ante. He said Gaddafi himself decided to rape as well women.
Yeah.
And so they produced a report. Now, as people put it, the dates together, it was October 21st that Gaddafi was assassinated. They was overthrown, the government. They set up these puppets. Government, you could say, in Libya was moved back to the Middle Ages practically.
Yes.
And in March 12th, 2012, in other words, the war was basically over, and because they'd overthrown the government, they put out the report, and of course, there's absolutely no mention of any Viagra, but Ocampo. There's no mention under the report of the investigators. Now, there's probably a little more serious report than Eric Moses' report, but the official report said there was no sign of it. But Ocampo said the new local authorities had ample proof of the use of Viagra and sexual violence. In other words. Somehow he wanted to keep the story going, in order to justify what had taken place, and of course Max Forte points out that there were allegations of his sexual misconduct in South Africa, in fact, and that they were saying that he wanted to steer the story away from him. Onto
my goodness, that's more involved than I remember. That's incidentally, it's an ancient notion that, of course, very often people who are go into the main square and shout accusations about somebody have done that themselves. And in history, it's not a surprising thing. I want to tell you, so we moved the Viagra. I'm amazed that they would go with this, because we do have a memory. Most people, when they hear any Viagra story in connection with crime or whatever, they remember actually that it was a hoax, rather like the weapons of mass destruction or the Kuwaiti, the poor nurse in Kuwait the Iraqi soldiers took the babies out of the incubators, and she turned out to be the daughter of the king of Kuwait. And Amnesty had introduced her to the world as a witness. I mean, these things become, about 6 months later, usually the truth catches up with these people. So I'm really surprised that they've decided to go one more time, going to go to the well and accuse. Now they're going to claim that the Russians are using Viagra in order to help to rape people.
Right. No, and exactly.
Incredible.
It's an insult.
I'm ashamed to be talking about it. Go on.
Yeah. No, it's an insult to people's intelligence that they can keep using this kind of trick to try and cover up what they themselves are doing. You know, like by backing a neo-Nazi outfit in the Ukraine, and also refusing, because, you know, talk about crimes committed. There were a lot of crimes committed before between 2014 and 2022.
Yes. Well, after the Maidan coup,
yeah,
this began the issue of violence, because a region of Ukraine said they don't accept the Maidan coup, they don't accept the new leaders, and therefore what followed was an attempt, violent attempt by the leaders to assert their sovereignty over a region that was rejecting them. Speaking to Robin Philpott, and by the way, and Robin Philpott's publisher of Baraka Books, the article is in Dimension magazine. You call out an organization by name, and I'm really glad you do, the International Bar Association.
Okay.
And you have the name Mark Ellis, and I was looking into Mark Ellis, who is their sort of all-purpose leader. And he, like Judge Mose, I read a long interview with him in the Los Angeles Review of Books, of all things.
Right.
And in the interview, he said, well, he knows about all these crimes, because he said he thought it was important that he go there personally, which to me is, I really get tired of these show trips. He visited, I think he said, a maximum 7 days, perhaps 10. But I would say, you call yourself a lawyer, and now you're giving, by the way, he's not being a lawyer, he's giving evidence. He knows that there is war crimes, crimes against humanity, been committed by one side, not two, but by one side. And then his organization proposes to work with that one side. And so we have the International Bar Association, Mark Ellis, and Mose. Mose has, you know, I mean, this is, to me, there's a great violation of ethics of some sort going on here, because lawyers, the ones I've dealt with, are very careful about what they claim they know. And also, when they find themselves being asked to be a party to a conflict or to support one side, they do acknowledge that there is another one. Otherwise, you can't have any process. There's not going to be a process. Yeah, obviously, anyone accused is going to say, who are you to accuse me? And on whose authority?
Exactly.
And Mose is putting that little blue coloration in to say, oh, it's the UN. But it is not the UN.
Yeah.
It is him and whoever appointed him to go. But the United Nations, we know, did not agree, because you have to have an affirmation by the General Assembly and the Security Council to do that.
Exactly.
You can't just run up the flag and say, this is what we think, when it's only you, Judge Mose.
Yeah. Well, and Ellis, you know, he just, I read that interview too. I think there was a link to it in the article, the International Bar Association. It's working very closely with the Ukrainian Bar Association. And so, but he wants the ICC, the International Criminal Court in The Hague, you know, the one we were talking about that Schaeffer helped develop. And he says the fact that Russia is not a member of the ICC is not a problem. And that's where he touches on an issue, which I think is at the center of what's going on. He said the military authorities could be indicted. Maybe it wouldn't be possible to arrest them right off, because the ICC doesn't have police to go and arrest people.
Yes.
But he said, with the regime change, these people will be able to get them in. And so what's this lawyer talking about regime change?
He's actually telling you he personally is a battering ram who belongs to Mr.
Right.
Schaeffer or
there
Schaefer or Schiffer.
Yeah, Schaeffer. That
Shiftier.
Shows the
Shiftier.
Point
I'm sorry,
about
Shiftier.
Schaeffer. You know, how Schaeffer, what he said there, and I guess, you know, I bet a lot of you are wishing he hadn't said it, and I hope that people use this quote, because it's so clear. My original, they edited it and did a good job of it, I have to say, but I couldn't even mention. But
well, I really like the alpha and omega, what's your point there? Because you look at this. The United States says no. They said it from day one, and they're saying it now. The ICC is never going to have any authority to investigate us or even talk about us. And if they come here, they will be arrested. That was, of course, President Trump. But we've noticed in the Biden administration that whatever the when it's a big issue, the Biden administration is carrying out the same policy as the Trump administration. We see it in almost every sphere regarding China, Russia, Iran. You can't find a space between what Trump was talking about and doing and what Biden is doing.
Exactly.
And if somebody said to them, "Oh, well, we can bring you to court," no, not a,
yeah.
So the American reading that would have to laugh. We're going to find. And by the way, they do laugh. The Americans smile. Because here they say, we'll fudge it and we'll find a way to get to charge Putin. But they don't say, and we would do the same to Americans. No,
right,
no, they wouldn't. Mr. Morales would faint in terror at the thought. But anyhow, by the way, we're speaking to Robin Philpott. And this, please read the article. It's in Dimension. He's also the publisher of Baraka Books. I realize with my time, we've got to take advantage of your presence to ask you, because Canada has a little problem sitting on its doorstep. And I would call it quiet alarm that several members of the Quebec legislature, the National Assembly, as it is called appropriately, have said they are not going to swear allegiance to King Charles.
It's a very interesting and important point. It's not a trivial thing, and people do try and trivialize it, but let's just see how it happened. The Quebec Solidaire, which is a number of votes, it was the second party in Quebec, the number of seats, it's the third after the governing party, which is the CAQ and the Liberals, but in number of votes, had already proposed a bill to abolish that. But the bill had never gotten in front of the National Assembly. So they were already talking about this. This was for the last couple of years. But during the campaign, the new leader of the PQ, Parti Québécois, is Paul Saint-Pierre Plamondon. A harder name to repeat. But he had said from the beginning, very calmly, he said he is not going to swear allegiance to the king. And he said it during the campaign, and he said it constantly, he's not going to do it. He didn't want to fudge because some people said, well, you do two oaths, an oath to the people of Quebec and an oath to the king. And he just said, no, I'm not going to do it at all. And he kept it up and kept it up, and then he was elected, which was surprised some people because it was a very close race, but he was elected. Now, there are three of the PQ, which one was once ran Quebec. It's down to a small group, but they were very lively, very good, and their program is social democratic, very social democratic this time. And so he was elected, and he's consistent. I'm not going to swear allegiance to the king. And so the 11 representatives of the Quebec Solidaire, which is sort of like a left sovereigntist party, also said they're not going to do it. So that makes 14. Now, they represent 30% of the votes in Quebec cast, which is quite considerable. Mm-hmm. And so they went. They had the first swearing-in ceremony, which was last week, and those 14 just refused to. They made an oath of allegiance to the people of Quebec, period. But the big test will be on the 29th of November. And that's when, because then if they're going to, they're in negotiations right now with the governing party, Legault, run by this guy, François Legault, and the Liberals, who now have got the hot potato because so many of the people, like something like 75% of Quebecers, according to polls, want to get rid of the monarchy, want to abolish it. Mm-hmm. And so, but they all, the Liberals and the governing party, all swear allegiance. So it is a hot potato. And I have to mention that the leader of the PQ made a very moving speech Friday when he refused to found it in English, but he said the only reason that the Quebec members of the National Assembly have to swear allegiance is because it is the result of a military conquest mm-hmm. in 1760, which following mm-hmm. the Plains of Abraham, and that is why we have to pledge allegiance to the king. Yeah. And the reason since then, it has been the under the name of that same symbol, the people in the Patriot Rebellion were hung, Louis Riel was hung, the Acadians were deported mm-hmm. because they refused to swear allegiance to the King of England. Mm-hmm. And so he said, there's no justification, and Quebecers have never been asked, would you like to swear allegiance to the King? And a very good speech, which places it in a historical context. So it is, I think it's a very major movement here. And people do try and trivialize it. They say, well, Quebecers or Canadians, because they brought it up in the federal parliament as well, are concerned about inflation, are concerned about this. but it's not a trivial thing. I like that
because it's a two-edged sword, right? I watched the Liberal minister jump to his feet and he said, oh, you're worried about your passions, but we're worried about unemployment and we're worried about the homeless. And so I would say to that man, well, then why don't you satisfy his passion, maybe? Right? He cares about all those things too. So,
yeah.
So you're gonna You say you care about the homeless. Why don't you set that aside? Is something terrible gonna happen if we don't swear our allegiance to? By the way, it's Charles and his descendants. They don't put that part in there. It's this one and anybody who succeeds him. So it could be the crazy Jack the Fourth. You know.
Yeah.
We've already sworn. We're already going to be his loyal subject.
But I mean, one of the things that comes to my mind for me is that, you know, they can, those two oaths can become contradictory very quickly. We're in a war situation now. Quebecers, the people of Quebec, have often opposed going to foreign war.
Well, for the same exact reasons, right?
Exactly. And so what happens? You pledge allegiance to the people of Quebec, who, in a majority of whom, do not want to go to war. But who's going to win in Quebec? I mean, if you decide you're going to oppose the king mm-hmm. and it's the king's representatives in Canada, which is the federal government,
which is the law.
Betrayal.
You want to see hysteria, by the way? Read Mr. Jakubowski in the Globe and Mail. I mean, he thinks that the world will collapse if you don't swear allegiance to Charles, because he says Charles represents the law.
Yeah.
And you say, oh, really? How interesting.
But the one thing that's raised is the symbolism, how important symbolism is. And I was talking about I have a radio program here. I was talking about it, you know, the British monarchy is symbolism at best. In other words, at its best and worst, but it's where the symbols, by getting all these people to bow down before the king and the late yes. queen in London or around the world, they managed to sweep under the rug a history of crimes.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the symbol yes. is a way to make us forget. Symbolism.
Well, or accept. Not only yeah, forget, yeah. but if you name it, they say, yes, I did that, and I remain your sovereign.
Right.
And you say, yes, my lord, I'm very sorry. I just wish you hadn't done that. Well,
yeah, and
they
will never apologize. As far as I know, they have never apologized for crimes they committed in Canada or else in the world. They'll sometimes say that, well, we have to look at it differently or so on. But
the Pope should apologize, but we didn't hear from the Queen.
Yeah, and the other thing is that, as I think you pointed out about that they do make exceptions for Scotland. Because you say you have to protect these Presbyterian faith, but
well, because Charles has sworn that he will protect their religion, the Presbyterian.
Yeah, but they don't even raise the question here, which Quebec no longer very Catholic, but it has a Catholic yeah. history.
By the way, this would be the time for people to get out their Fate of Thomas More. Because he was simply a man of conscience, you remember. He said, he withdrew under Henry VIII. He said, okay, I can't do this anymore. I'm not a hypocrite. And they said, well, okay, but you still have to swear. And he says, and he was a private citizen by that. I mean, he no longer in government. They had brought him into government. He was no longer in government. And he said, no, I can't do that. And they said, well, and he lost his head.
Okay.
So, he chopped off the head of one of the most brilliant men in British history.
That's
what you do with brains.
Right. So, but anyway, it's something to watch. It's something to watch. And
well, what do you think is going to happen? Are they going to be able to take the heat? Because they're going to be, this is, the gauntlet has been thrown down. And the premier, by the way, he's a former PQ man, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
He must be a little uncomfortable.
Well, he and a lot of his colleagues in his party, they must say, they have to say, have a certain amount of respect for the new leader of the PQ, because he's the man who brought it to the fore, along with the Quebec Solidaire. But and the interesting thing is that it's brought these two parties together who've been feuding over a number of issues and to actually work together. And so,
well, who took the lead? Was it Solidaire took the lead or Plamondon?
No, it was Plamondon was the guy who
he took the lead.
He took the lead during the campaign.
He stole the march on the Quebec Solidaire.
Yeah. You have to give it to Quebec Solidaire. They'd already presented a motion three years ago, but for some reason hadn't been pushed forward, and it might not have been a big priority for them. So it's like, but the man who brought it, the person who brought it to the head here during this campaign this fall is Plamondon. He's done it very, very in a very dignified manner, and I'm sure.
Well, we will find that speech. You've already told us. Sounds like a historic speech, the kind that every Canadian should read.
Right.
And by the way, do you know that they're worried in Ottawa because this little fire could burn way into English Canada too? Because we're a multicultural society, and many of the people making up the multicultural city of Toronto, for example, do not wish to swear allegiance to the British Crown because they have some historic memories.
Fortunately.
Historic memories.
Exactly.
Robin, we better let you go. It's near closing time. We thank you very, very much. Robin Philpott, Dimension Magazine, please read it. And thanks again.
Thank you, Phil. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Bye. This is Taylor Report, CIUT, counting down, and I think we're very near closing. As a matter of fact, well, we got just a minute. I'll just remind you that Saturday, the Hamilton Coalition Stop the War, you can go to their site and you will find the report and all the speeches that were given and the discussion. So it's Phil Taylor for the Taylor Report, and we'll see you next week. We'll be right back.